Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Queensbury Rules Radio. Once again, I'm Patrick Connor from QueensburyRules.com, joined here by James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. James, are you there?
Yeah, I am here. What's going on?
James. What's going down, brother?
Same old.
Yeah, it was not a too bad a weekend for boxing, I guess, but wasn't a whole lot to do, I suppose, in comparison to the last handful of weeks that we've been doing the show and recapping and previewing, et cetera. But the important fight, I suppose, was pretty damn good. Karl Frotch versus Mikko Kessler 2. But also, I guess before we get discussing anything, I should just remind everybody that we're going to be having Andrew Fruman from Cruelest Sport on the show here in just a few minutes. So we'll be eagerly awaiting him calling in. But first, I guess I'll just kill some time until he gets here. How did you score the Frotch-Kessler 2 rematch? Because the reason why I ask is because I've actually seen a number of scorecards that have been kind of, you know, there have been a fairly wide span of scores that I've seen. I've seen anywhere from a couple people had Kessler winning, actually, by a point or two. And then, you know, me, I had it somewhere around, I'd say, about 9-3 for Frotch. I thought that it was a fun fight, but I thought Frotch won pretty clearly. How'd you score it?
Yeah, I had it somewhere in that. I think I had it around 7-5. You know, and I wasn't like completely scoring 100% focus round by round. I watched the fight actually kind of at like a bigger gathering, so it was kind of tough to like, you know, pay full attention. And then when I rewatched it, I only watched like the last six rounds again. But I thought Frock won. I guess when I was watching it live, I was surprised that the HBO guys had it so wide, because I thought as he was rallying into, like, you know, the 9th, 10th, 11th, I was thinking it could be a pretty close fight. But Frock getting that, coming strong and finishing that 12th round, I think kind of put it over the edge, made it, you know, out of reach on my card. But like I said, I mean, I kind of just vaguely had it a 7-5 fight. But I think there were more clear rounds for Frotch than for Kessler. It was a really good fight, you know.
Yeah, there were a handful of rounds that kind of could have gone either way. You know, it kind of seems to be a recurring theme for a lot of the fights that we've been talking about lately, where we've been kind of recapping exactly how we score fights. And I think that's important too, not just for people who have been scoring fights for a long time and are familiar with it. Also for people who are, you know, new to the sport and, you know, they see scorecards and they're like, how the hell did they come up with those type of scores? But, you know, I thought that it was an entertaining fight. Kessler, as always, you know, gave a really game effort. Well, I don't want to say as always to make it sound like he loses a lot, because it was only his third loss in a fairly long career. But, you know, he really gave a really good effort. I thought that in the 11th round there, that was kind of his last stand in the fight. It was a really good round. And overall,
he fought well in the first half of the 12th round, too.
Yeah.
And then kind of got caught with some stuff.
I don't know that a stoppage was as close as a lot of people thought it was. I thought that if Kessler had been stopped in the 12th, that would have been a pretty premature stoppage myself.
Yeah, it would have been a horrible stop. There was a moment, and maybe the referee was just in kind of an awkward position, but he was kind of like leaning in there when Frotch had him on the ropes with about 20 seconds left. And it had the appearance of a guy who looked like he was getting close to stopping it, but it would have been an awful stoppage. I don't think Kessler was that badly hurt. But just to quickly on your point, you know, it's extremely rare for a fight, I mean, extremely rare, where you have just 12 definitive rounds, you know, unless it's just like a really one-sided, you know, type of fight. I mean, most fights that are anywhere in that 8-4, 7-5, 9-3 type of range, you know, there's always a few close ones that you kind of just lean toward one guy or the other. So I think that's what's so ridiculous about when people argue over scorecards when you're talking about, you know, 115, 113 fights where one or two rounds swings it the other way. But overall, I thought this was, I guess you could have, you know, I think scoring this for Kessler would have been a mistake. I didn't see it as being that debatable who won.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to say speak for you, basically, but I will say that I have crawled up judges' asses for scorecards they've had many a time. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the times we don't notice them. And so in those instances, we should really give them credit, I guess, when we don't notice them, just like for when referees are in there and we don't notice the referees. And there's a reason why judges and referees and the officials, they actually go through a fair amount of training before being able to officiate these fights. And so there's a reason why, you know, these judges and these referees and whatnot, they all differ on, you know, they have differing opinions on these calls. And so I could see how a lot of people could, I actually saw quite a few scorecards that were a draw for the fight. But yeah, I mean, I'm not really big on having that fight super close or having Kessler winning. Although at the same time, you know, I will give him credit, and Frotch gave him credit after the fight too. It was really I don't know if you saw the Sky Sports interview. I actually a little bit posted the interview on the Queensbury Rules website. Basically, it was refreshing interview because they were both given each other a lot of praise, and they both seemed to be fairly happy after the fight. There wasn't any whining. There wasn't any kind of like, you know, I totally got screwed by this guy's hometown or anything like that. Kessler basically just said, you know, look, it was a hard fight. I tried really hard in the 11th to close the show and couldn't do it. And Frotch is a tough dude.
They're both gentlemen, you know, and I think with Kessler, I think he's a little bit cleaner of a boxer, and his punches are a little crisper. His hands, I think, are a little bit faster. So when he was catching Frotch with those right hands, it was a little bit more visible. But at the same time, you know, you have to factor in that Frotch was just walking right through those shots, and you know, just chin. Kessler wasn't reacting as well when he was getting hit. He was backing up a lot more, and that just visually gives the appearance that one guy's punches are doing more damage. So, you know, in that sense, I mean, I think Kessler had made it kind of tough on himself, especially that I felt like Frock won maybe the first three rounds or four rounds. And so I think getting off to that lead, once Kessler started to kind of get back in the fight and time him, it was just too much to overcome. And then Frock, I think having that big 12th round, like I saw a guy scoring the 12th round even, which just kind of blew my mind, because I thought Frock, with the work that Frotch did in the last minute or so, really completely outweighed what Kessler did. I thought he had Kessler, you know, stumbling back there a little bit and actually hurt.
Well, we got Andy on the line here, Mr. Fruman. But real quick, I wanted to kind of finish. I had a thought that I didn't want to lose.
Okay.
But I wanted to say that I thought that the HBO crew, they made a really good point during the fight a handful of times, that essentially, for whatever reason, Kessler's feet looked really awkward, and he was falling off balance a lot of times when he was getting hit. And I think that that gave the appearance that he was more hurt than he really was. And so I'm not saying that he wasn't stunned or wobbled a couple times, because it did look like he was stunned or wobbled a few times. But, you know, it just the way that he reacted with his balance and with his feet just made him look like he got hurt. And so I think that that also contributed to maybe scorecards that some people thought were a little too wide or not close enough. But that being said, Mr. Fruman, are you there?
Mr. Connor, I am here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, man. We really appreciate it.
Am I coming through loud and clear?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yes, you are. You're coming in real clear.
Mr. Foley, good to speak with you as well.
First guest with no audio difficulties right off the bat.
Wow.
So that's good. That's a good sign.
Fantastic.
We were
there's a few minutes of the show in my attempt to connect. So I just heard the last few moments there when you were talking about the balance issues that Kessler
had. Yeah, we were We just went ahead and kind of worked right into the Frosch-Kessler rematch conversation, but we'd love to get your take on it and how you scored it, what you thought of it, et cetera.
Sure. Well, you know, I didn't score the fight closely. I've only seen it once. I'm having DVR issues, which are kind of distressing. So I
white
wasn't able to record
problems,
it.
Man. First world
I know,
problems.
I know. These are. But, you know, you watch a fight. I always like to watch a fight a second time and score it if it's a close fight before I, you know, start yelling about how I scored it. And I haven't had a chance to do that. But watching live, I thought Frotch won. I thought, you know, 7-5, 8-4, maybe to the extreme 9-3, you could make a case. I mean, you know, for me, it came down to the fact that I thought Frotch was hurting Kessler more than the reverse. I think Frotch took Kessler's punches pretty well. Kessler didn't take Frotch's punches pretty well. And you guys touched on that, you know, with the balance issue. But, I mean, that's a factor. If your balance isn't great and when you get hit, you go backwards, you wobble a bit. I mean, you know, that counts.
Certainly. And on top of that, I have seen a couple people mention it, but, you know, I think that it bears repeating that, you know, Kessler really just sailed some hard-ass punches at Frotch's face. And, I mean, I obviously we can't say for sure, but it seemed to me like they were the type of punches that would have bowled over a number of super middleweights. And, I mean, there was a couple left hooks and a couple right hands, and I want to say either the eighth or ninth rounds where Kessler almost looked like pissed off or something like that when he threw him because, man, he just threw the shit out of him. And they landed perfectly and nothing.
Yeah, Frotch,
there was no reaction, nothing.
I think it was only in the 11th round when Kessler, I think, was it a counter right he landed? And he kind of stunned Frotch for a moment or two. But that was the only time where, you know, anything really seemed to register. I mean, he, as you said, he landed a lot of good punches, but I think it was only in the 11th round that he actually hurt Frotch, and Frotch recovered fairly quickly and was okay by the end of the round. But I was very impressed with the way Kessler, who looked like he might get run over in the first few rounds, was standing his ground in the middle round and really launching hard counters. I mean, I think we see it very often in fights where one guy is physically stronger than the other guy, and he imposes his will early, and he just has his way. And in this fight, it really looked like that was what was going to happen early. And I think it was maybe the second or third round where Kessler looked shook, and he just didn't look like he belonged in the ring with Frotch. And then in the middle rounds, even though he was still getting hit, he was standing his ground, and as you said, he was launching these huge shots. And I really wasn't expecting that from him. I didn't think he had it in him anymore, but he did, and, you know, made for a great fight.
Yeah, and I think it was telling, too, when he hurt him in the 11th round, I mean, he really went after him and unloaded on him. You know, I mean, he still had enough energy to kind of make one last, you know, push at it, and you know, Frotch just withstood it. By the, you know, halfway through the 12th round, he really just turned it back around, and I think Kessler kind of given everything that he had at that point. And I mean, Frotch again just proved that he's a, you know, if not some kind of a great boxer, he's just one of the toughest guys in the sport.
Yeah, he's remarkably durable, and that's, you know, I think in other sports, you know, sometimes the whole thing of who wants it more is a bit of an overused cliche. But when it comes to boxing, that extra toughness, and we see it, we saw it with Frotch, is, you know, can take a fighter very far. I think Frotch's skills are a little underrated, but, I mean, I think his timing is very good. But still, I mean, his toughness is what sets him apart and has allowed him to be so successful.
And how about that crowd? What do you guys have to, I mean, the ring walks were, I mean, I think that if any of the U.S. fans were not really used to watching international feeds or shows from the U.K. or overseas, I think that a lot of U.S. fans are not really used to seeing those type of ring walks. I mean, for the most part here, like, for example, in Vegas, let's just say, for example, a lot of the time a ring walk is basically just a guy surrounded by his 30-member deep posse walking into the ring, you know, into a crowd, and you can barely see where the guy is except for he's on the big screen or something like that.
Yeah.
Because the camera's in his face. But, I mean, like, the sound is usually drowned out. You can't really hear the music that great unless you're there live, you know, et cetera. So, you know, what? How about that friggin' crowd?
Yeah, that was, you know what, that's a, and you mentioned we don't really get that. We could do in Montreal, but I was going to say we don't really get that in North America very often. And I think a lot of that is because fighters are fighting far from their home base. And so they just don't have that kind of enthusiastic support. And, you know, when we see fights in the UK, there's always that atmosphere. And, I mean, you know, that always, it just makes the fight seem better, even if it's not the roar of the crowd, the intensity. It just feels a little different.
It's just something I think that a lot of American fans aren't used to, and that I wish we just had more of. It would make the going to fights live experience a little more pleasant. And on top of that, I feel like I have actually made a couple of boxing fans, you know, out of taking people to fights live. I mean, not a ton, but, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, they hate boxing, or I'm not a big fan of boxing. Well, have you ever seen it live? No. Well, you know, even taking them to kind of a local card and stuff like that, I'm not going to say it turns them into a hardcore fight fanatic, but it seems to sway them a little bit. And I think that going to an event like that would just be the tits.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, that's one of the problems with boxing in North America, is that there just aren't too many options for those kind of fights with that kind of atmosphere. And, I mean, too often now, you know, with fighters and promoters worried about hometown advantages, we see fights at neutral locations where there's even less of an atmosphere. And, I mean, we are facing that sort of situation now with a potential fight with Ward and Frock, where, I mean, does Ward actually want to go to the UK and fight Frock, where he knows there's going to be 18,000, 20,000 people rooting for the other guy.
And speaking of which, just to kind of transition to the next, I guess, the next topic, on the undercard of that was Tony Bellew versus Isaac Chilemba, the rematch of their first fight. And that was, I don't want to say controversial necessarily, I didn't really think that the result was super controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was kind of paying attention live on Twitter, and I didn't get to see the fight live, unfortunately, because I usually work on Saturday days, but I was kind of just paying attention to what everyone was saying during the fight, and then I watched it later so that I could kind of not have the results spoiled for me. But it seemed when I went back and read a lot of the news about it, it seemed that a lot of people felt it was a controversial decision. They felt the first fight was a controversial decision, and that Chilemba just deserved more respect,
mm-hmm.
both going into the fight and for the decision. So, I mean, how did you guys see that fight, both you, James, and Andrew?
James, you want to go ahead first?
I mean, I didn't have a problem with the decision. I'm kind of with you on that. I don't think there was enough of a gap there to where either guy really had a gripe whether they didn't get it. I mean, obviously, Bellew was going to get it in his, you know, in his hometown. But I didn't think Chilemba did enough to definitively claim a win there. But, you know, I don't know if either of these guys really interests me as, like, a high-level contender at light heavyweight.
I'm on the same page. I actually thought the first fight, I thought Chilemba did clearly win. I thought he, the first half of the fight was fairly even. I thought he dominated the second half, but the fight on Saturday I thought was closer. I mean, there was a lot of ineffective aggression and ineffective countering. It was It was very messy, and you know, neither guy really got a lot done. So, I mean, I didn't. You know what? I didn't have a huge issue with the cards. I mean, whether Belly really deserved to win it or not, maybe not. But it wasn't like Chalemba deserved to win it either. So, you know, the hometown guy got the decision. Not a big deal. But I agree with James. I just don't really see either of those guys doing much more. I think this is probably their ceiling. So, you know, I mean, but being a fringe top 10 guy, I mean, you know, maybe they'll get a title shot. I mean, if it is against Chad Dawson, I don't think either will win more than a couple rounds.
Yeah, and I can't really say much for Adonis Stevenson if he does wind up coming out on top in that matchup, but it sounds like that's basically the plan, that Bellew is in line to face the winner of that fight. But to go back to the Chalemba fight, I agree on both points, and I think that the first fight, Chalemba probably had a better case to say that he was actually robbed or deserved the decision. But I thought that there were probably about five or so rounds in this second fight that literally just could have gone either way. And I mean, literally, and I know that sometimes when you say that, or if you score even rounds, people are saying, oh, you're indecisive, you know, the round has to go one way or the other. And hey, you know, maybe so. Maybe if you really want to come up with some type of formula where you can quantify who won a round or whatever, that's fine, but I don't have one. And so,
no, I don't have one
just
either.
Kind of, and you know, I think, and just kind of watching it, it's, you can't, I felt that there were literally a good five rounds that could have gone either way. And when you have that, you can
the guy fighting
pretty
at home
weird
gets,
scores.
Gets the benefit of the doubt when there's a situation like that. And I agree with you. I mean, there was several rounds that were very close. And I'm also, you know, I think we're in the minority here, but I'm also in favor of scoring more even rounds, because I think there are so many rounds where people end up either guessing or going with a style preference or pulling something out of their head, like who landed the hardest punch in the round, or, you know, who looked more comfortable. And, I mean, these are very subjective criteria. So when you can't clearly separate two fighters, I'm more in favor of saying 10-10 than just kind of randomly going with, you know, whatever preference scorer might have.
Yeah, why is it, since you guys are both, you know, boxing historians, why did judges stop doing that or get discouraged from doing that? I mean, I've read, like, a few ridiculous scores where, that, you know, a 15-round fight was, like, you know, 5-5, 3-2, you know, 5 draw, or 10 even rounds and 3-2, you know, but when did that happen?
You know, I don't remember. I think Duran Leonard won. One of the judges, I think, scored 10 even rounds.
There was a couple of funky scores.
And, I mean, that might have been the catalyst. But I think it was around the late 70s or early 80s when they started the push for having to decide a winner for every round. Because, you know, there's so many examples before then where, you know, you can look at the scorecards and there are multiple even rounds. And, I mean, if you know, I know Patrick reads a lot of boxing history, and when you go and read the write-ups for fights from, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, you'll see writers saying, I had the score 5-3 with 5 rounds even, or 4-2 with 6 rounds even, or et cetera. You know, writers had no problem saying they had several even rounds, but now when you look at, you know, how people score fights, even, you know, writers have no obligation to pick a winner in every round, because we're not officially scoring the fight, but still, everybody scoring fights 7-5, 8-4, 9-3, etc. You know, so it's there has been a change, and in my opinion, I prefer the old method. I'd rather call it 10-10 than, you know, split hairs.
Well, in a sense, you're kind of
sorry,
I was just gonna say you're letting the decisive rounds decide the fight rather than, you know, the close ones.
Exactly, and I think that's better. I mean, I'd much rather have a fight, decided by the decisive rounds than the close rounds. I mean, if one guy wins 4 decisive rounds, the other guy won, and then there's 7 very close rounds, technically the guy who had the 4-1 edge in decisive rounds could still lose the fight 8-4, and everyone would defend the card, saying, well, there were so many close rounds, you can make an argument for the other guy. But, I mean, in reality, the guy for 4-1 Edge is probably the worthy winner.
I think that's happened in a few of the really controversial decisions the last few years, like with like Paul Williams and Arislandi Lara. You know, it's like every round that Lara won, he's doing a ton of damage and snapping his head back and really, you know, effective stuff. But there was maybe seven rounds that were, you know, more reasonably close just with all Williams's activity. And, you know, if you gave him all of those, you had him squeaking by, you know, just by a hair. And, of course, everyone thought that decision was, you know, pretty awful.
Right. And, I mean, that's a pretty good example. And, I mean, that's another fight where you're looking at what do judges prefer. And, I mean, there are some judges who will just score aggression and just score activity. And, you know, I mean, when you're talking about only three judges, you could have a situation where two might have some preference for activity and you get a crazy result.
Well, and kind of to branch off the history aspect of it, what Mr. Fruman was talking about here a moment ago, to bring it back, and I know that I've mentioned this for a number of different topics, but I think it really does apply. I think that when networks started airing fights a little bit more, and when networks got involved in airing fights, and therefore they were simply just more visible live, I think that it changed a number of different things in the sport, including scoring, and I don't really have a ton of evidence to back that up, you know, any hardcore evidence, but I think that it's just, it really comes down to more like immediate gratification, where if you have decisive scores, you know, if you have viewers tuning in, and these guys fight really hard, like, for example, in the Frotch-Kessler rematch, you know, these guys are fighting really hard. They're giving their all. There's a couple of close rounds. You know, it's a fairly evenly contested fight for the most part. People don't want to see a draw, even if it should be a draw. People don't want to see the draw, you know, and I think that it kind of just started tipping in the direction of encouraging referees and judges to be more decisive with their scoring. And like I said, I obviously don't have any real evidence of that, but that's just kind of the feeling that I get when you look at how fights used to be scored. And I mean, for a very long time, fights were scored by a referee or by a referee and one judge, you know? And so
Correct.
A lot of the time there would be no decisions or no contests or draws because the referee scored it one way and the judge scored it another way. So, I mean, there has been kind of like a change as far as how fights are scored, and I just feel like TV has just been a huge catalyst for a lot of things in the sport. And, you know, speaking of TV, we had Friday night fights this past week, and I don't know, I kind of talked it down last week with Mr. Greisman on the show, but, you know, you guys, James and David Greisman, you guys wound up being pretty much spot on over my bullshit call, apparently, because Delvin Rodriguez and Freddie Hernandez wound up fighting a fairly even and fun fight for the most part. So I got to give kudos to you guys for calling it right. But, you know, I guess the TV
just
exposure
Hernandez
carries
having,
on.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, Hernandez having hung in there against, I think, guys who are better than Rodriguez made me think it would be somewhat competitive. It was a fun fight. It was an interesting fight, kind of a weird ending to it. And I still don't know how I feel about that, going to replay and then ruling that it was a TKO. Because one of the things I was thinking is, you know, even if there could have still have been a headbutt earlier in that round that kind of opened that area and then the punches opened it up. I mean, I don't know, technically I guess that is a TKO, but I kind of in some ways prefer some of that stuff to still be in the referee's hand, kind of like a baseball umpire. I mean, I don't know, I guess you have to get the right call, but in my mind this was kind of something that could have, you kind of could have argued either way what the cause of the cuts were, and I think just looking at the footage in of those that last exchange, I don't know if that was necessarily like entirely revealing. What did you guys think about that?
Well, I thought it was overall good, but I did have a slight problem with it, which I'll say in a minute. I'd rather hear Mr. Fruman's take on it first.
Yeah, I'd rather get the call right, but, I mean, my question is that the way the Illinois Commission operates? I mean, was it agreed upon before the fight that there would be instant replay, or was this just something decided after the fact? Because, yeah, I'm in favor of getting the call right. I agree with James that, you know, I'm not quite sure it was entirely definitive because there might have been a smaller cut opened by a headbutt earlier, and perhaps the punch did exacerbate that. But, I mean, it looked on the replay like those right hands did open the cut. And so I think, you know, technically, you know, a TKO was the right call, but I mean, I'm wondering if what the ruling is with instant replay in that state.
Well, I wonder. I don't know exactly what the rules are as far as that, but you know, a time that we've seen before where there's a headbutt early on that creates some kind of a minor thing, and then throughout the fight it gets worse as more and more punches are landed on it, and that always ends up being, you know, a technical decision if it ends up the fight has to get stopped. So I just felt like in this case it was probably, I mean, considering the nature of that cut, it certainly looked like something that would have been caused by a clash of heads. But, you know, certainly it opened up badly as a result of those last two punches. So I don't know. I guess I didn't really have a problem with the referee making a call in that decision. It didn't seem like something that an instant replay, you know, without analyzing the entire fight or the entire round, you could have just, you know, quickly determined that.
Well, and I think that it's probably more likely than not that the cut was caused by a head or by a punch. Sorry, I think that was fairly likely considering the replay. However, it did come off as kind of half cocked, especially since it was like, you know, as everything was unfolding, it was like, whoa, so this is what we're going to do. Well, great. You know, it just kind of seemed like everyone was surprised that the right call was being made or something. But my issue with it, like I said, I think that the right call probably was made. But my issue with it is that it seemed almost kind of spurred on by the Friday Night Fights commentators. And so it's kind of like to me when, you know, I'm trying to think of an example of like a ringside official getting involved, but basically, for example, Ollie Liston too, where Ollie hits him with the quote unquote phantom punch, Liston goes down, Ollie won't go to a neutral corner, and he's being pushed to the neutral corner by, I think it was Jersey Joe Walcott.
Yeah, right.
And then
he got up ready to
Walcott's,
fight, and then they waved it off.
Yeah. And Walcott's like looking around, like, what the hell do I do? And then they resume fighting, and Ollie storms at Liston, and then I forget who it was, but it was, I want to say it was like Nat Fleischer or somebody like that with like, you know, some heft from ringside yelling, you know, he didn't get up before 10, he didn't get up before 10, it was 10 seconds, and then the fight gets called off. And so in any event, my point is just that it seems as though when these guys that have expertise in a different area in not officiating but commentating, when they're kind of spurring on this change, it just worries me a little bit. It worries me that, you know, some other instance will come up where Jim Lampley's yelling, you know, no, that was a TKO, or, you know, come on, give the guy a break, as Carlos Molina gets stopped by Kirkland or something, you know. So it just kind of worries me that it might be setting the wrong precedent, even though, in retrospect, the right call may have been made. Do you know what I mean?
Right, and I think that goes back to the procedure of how, I mean, you know, who's in charge and what are the rules in play. I mean, if the rules there are that they have instant replay and instant replay can overrule the referee's decision, then, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing if the commentators bring that to the attention of whoever's in charge. And what I was unclear about was whether that actually was the rules.
Or they were just kind of making them up as they went
along. Right,
exactly.
Well, that's another thing for boxing fans. It's just with all the different jurisdictions and different, you know, localities, look at like the Bernard Hopkins-Chad Dawson first fight. I mean, and the case like that, they can't overturn the decision until, you know, a month later and there's a hearing. And then you watch Friday Night Fights and that happens. And I think it's another problem with not having some kind of a uniform code that governs all the bodies. I mean, at least in the United States, because, you know, that's a big deal whether you can go to replay or not. It would affect the outcome of on a different fights.
Right, exactly.
And I know this subject. I think that this subject might seem kind of boring to some people, but I think it's actually very, very interesting because over the last maybe 12 to 15 years, the evolution of how fights are governed and officiated has kind of, it's kind of shifted a little bit. And I don't know if you guys remember, but, and I want to say, I think it was 2001 when Jesse James Leja fought Hector Camacho Jr. And then, you know, it was kind of controversial. A lot of people were bemoaning Camacho Jr. as they have done his entire career and calling him a pussy and all this type of stuff. He actually incurred a fairly small cut right under his eyebrow. And I will, you know, I don't want to jump in there and start, you know, bashing fighters as I used to do, but I will admit in this case, the cut was very small and it didn't seem to be hindering his vision at all. And it happened after a round that he just happened to kind of get, you know, slapped around a little bit. He wound up bowing out, saying that he couldn't see. And then basically it was ruled a certain way at the time, and it was ruled to be, if I'm not mistaken, like a no contest or no decision. And then it actually got taken to court a couple weeks later, and it was like the result was slightly changed. And in that case, it was actually one of the first cases that they could point to where that had actually happened, where anything happened to the result in retrospect, because fighters had been trying to do that for years, you know. After getting robbed or whatever, they would say, oh, you know, I'm going to take it up with the commission or I'm going to take it here or there. And for the most part, nothing would ever happen because, as we were just talking about, there seemed to be a very clear precedent in terms of how fights and how results were rendered. And if you didn't agree with it, then, oh, well, that was too bad. You didn't really have any recourse to go back and say, oh, I need to do this or talk to this person or go through this avenue. Nothing happened. And so I think that since then, like, for example, Hopkins-Dawson won, there have been a handful of examples where fighters were able to kind of, you know, protest a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's a really subjective sport, obviously, and they've tried to kind of quantify it. And, you know, it's a little different issue, but, like, things like CompuBox and all that, which is, you know, again, it's like, you know, there has to be a certain element of this that's just left up to people to decide, judges, referees, and there's situations that happen where, you know, you don't necessarily want it to be, like, so black and white, because that kind of takes away from a little bit of, I don't know, like, I think there's decisions that the referee should be able to make in the ring that, you know, some of them should be challengeable, but others I think shouldn't.
What's your take on this whole kind of officiating issue, Mr. Fruman?
You know, I mean, you know, part of me wants to say that it just doesn't matter, because the actual results in so many cases, especially for smaller fights like Rodriguez-Hernandez, have no bearing on the future for either fighter. It's not like in other sports where you've got a win-loss record and you've got a schedule and, you know, the results will affect who gets into the playoffs, etc. In boxing, so often it doesn't really matter what the end result is. I mean, sure, it goes in your record, but in terms of determining what happens next, it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't know if anything changes for Freddie Hernandez or Delvin Rodriguez based on the result. And that's even if, say, the fight had gone to the cards and let's say Hernandez would have won the fight, I'm still not sure if anything changes for either guy.
Yeah, probably not.
So in terms
I think that's a pretty fair point.
Yeah, so in terms of worrying about these sort of things, I don't know. But I can see if we do open up these situations to having changes made on results, you know, you have to always wonder, I mean, are fighters with bigger promotional pushes going to get better treatment than other fighters? You know, if something happens to a fighter, a bigger name fighter, is he going to be in a position where he's just going to have, let's say, more important people arguing his case? So, you know, who knows? Who knows?
Well, I think in many times, though, it affects the perception of things, you know, the official result. I mean, especially when you go back and, I mean, like Manny Pacquiao, Tim Bradley. I mean, I don't think Pacquiao got any credit for that win because everyone was busy talking about how horrible the result was.
At the same time, Bradley didn't get any credit for the win either. So, I mean, the actual official decision.
Well, he got the opposite of credit.
He did.
He got hate.
He did. And the actual official decision, you know, did nothing for Bradley's career, and it did nothing to hurt Pacquiao's career. I mean, Pacquiao went on to another fight that he might have taken if he got the decision anyway. So there's just another example of a result that people disagreed with, and in the end, it didn't actually affect what happened next.
I think that's a pretty fair point, but I know that you're going to have to go in about 15 to 20 minutes, so I guess I was going to just try to get through some more stuff before you go, so we're not sitting here talking about the same thing all day. But I had sent you guys a link to the Omar Narvaez versus Felipe Urrutia fight. And we've talked about Narvaez a couple times here on the show, but just for anybody who isn't aware, even though there probably aren't too many first-time boxing fans listening, I'll say it anyway. Narvaez he was a longtime WBO flyweight title holder. He's an Argentinian guy. To be honest, I'm really not entirely sure how popular he is in Argentina, but I know that pretty much all of his fights are broadcast on a channel down there called TYC, which is basically the kind of Argentinian local sports channel, and a lot of boxing matches are shown on it, actually. So anyway, he fought this guy named Urrutia, and he wound up getting a split decision over 12 rounds. I'm not sure if either of you had the chance to watch that, but basically, to me, what it wound up looking like was this guy, Urrutia, didn't really seem to have anything special, any type of, really redeeming qualities or anything like that. He seemed to just kind of, in my opinion, probably deserve a fairly close decision just for working hard. And actually, I think that's how the fight was described to me even before I watched it, and I would basically agree with exactly that. So did you guys have a chance?
Yeah, I watched the fight, and I mean, I thought it was very close. It could have gone either way. I mean, it reminded me in some ways maybe of the first Mayweather-Castillo fight, not in, you know, how good the fighters were, but in the pattern of the fight, and, you know, you had one guy coming forward, throwing wider shots, not really landing that cleanly very often, and another guy doing some very good defensive work, landing single shots here and there, and then sliding out of trouble. And I thought, I thought it was very close. It could have gone either way. I mean, Urrutia came on strong down the stretch and seemed to do his best work late. But I thought Narvaez landed a lot of sneaky little shots inside. I mean, he kept catching him with these great little left hands when Urrutia came in, and he did a very good job of blocking shots with his elbows and rolling with shots. And, you know, the other thing that was striking was the size difference. I mean, Narvaez looked tiny in there. Urrutia looked like this, big, strong, what was the weight, 115 pounds? He looked considerably bigger. I mean, it almost looked like Daner versus Narvaez. And yet Narvaez somehow neutralized him. And I thought had a case for legitimately winning. I mean, I didn't really have a problem with the decision.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a robbery by any means, and that word was thrown about a couple times, and I think that the reason for that was because Narvaez is Argentinian, and the fight was there, and basically they were just saying, you know, he's the hometown guy, and, you know, that's why they gave him the decision. But no, nah, it was a close fight. I mean, James, did you have a chance to catch it?
I did not. I'm sorry. You got nothing really to offer
James,
here.
James, man.
That's appalling.
Fucking
I'm appalled.
James, man.
Sorry.
And you call yourself an expert. What is this shit?
I've never called myself a Narvaez expert.
Fair enough, dude.
Yeah,
well,
it's worth watching, though.
I thought it was a pretty decent fight.
Yeah,
I have it on my
fight.
List here, but none of this stuff would play when I was trying to watch it. I don't know if it was my computer or what, but I was freezing like every 30 seconds. So I was just like, I was watching the Roman Gonzalez fight, and I basically just fast forwarded it to watch the last minute because I couldn't get it to go without being choppy.
Yeah, well, I guess. You could still kind of get in on the conversation here, and that is, I guess I'll just briefly say, you know, it seems to me like Narvaez is almost turned into kind of like a Argentinian Darius Michalczewski, except for Michalczewski never came over to the U.S. to try to ply his trade against somebody bigger, and Narvaez did against Onaide, but in his case, his outing was just crappy, and nobody really cared to see him after that, I don't think. But
you know,
I want to say 37, but anyway, my point is just that he's tucked himself away and kind of away from the competition, and he was in a division that was fairly deep there for a bit, and it's kind of starting to trickle out. But anyway, as far as Narvaez goes and his legacy and his entire career, what do you think, Fruman?
I mean, you sum things up pretty well, but I think it's just a little unfortunate, the circumstances, because he's a very good fighter. He's a very crafty fighter. He's, you know, a lot of the little defensive skills that, you know, we don't see too often anymore. I mean, he's very adept at that sort of thing, and it's just a shame that the one opportunity he had was a fight that he really had no chance to win whatsoever. It was just a terrible style matchup against a bigger, harder-hitting, younger counterpuncher who just didn't suit his game. And, you know, he had no chance, in my opinion, to look good in that fight. If he actually tried to take the fight to Nonito, he would have got knocked out. And so he did what he did. He fought to survive, and he took a lot of heat for it, but, you know, he was able to continue his career. Let's say he fights Nonito and he gets knocked out in 3 rounds and he's never the same, and he can't go back to Argentina and earn a living. So I thought he was in a no-win situation, and it's just too bad for him that one time North American fans got a chance to see him was in a fight which was a mismatch from the time it was signed. So that's my defense of Narvaez.
Well, and I think that also, even just stylistically, you know, even just kind of looking at the way that he fights, that, in my opinion, against Donaire was not, I would not characterize that as your typical Omar Narvaez performance, because he's usually a little bit more, and I'm sorry for the reference, Mr. Whitaker, but a little bit more like Pernell Whitaker in his defense and the way that he fights, mm-hmm. rather than that fight where he was really mobile and just staying the hell away. And like you said, probably just trying to salvage the knockout, you know, and say, well, you know, I'm not going to get knocked out over here in America. I'm just going to come here, collect my check, say I fought Nonito Donaire, went well with him, and I'm going to go home. But in reality, in the vast majority of the fights of his that I've seen, he's more of a kind of nip and tuck type of guy where he'll swivel around you rather than run away and then counter. And like you said, he has that really sneaky overhand left where he can just kind of, it just, and he even caught Donaire with it a handful of times. It just didn't do anything.
but it's a really sneaky punch. He has quick hands. Even as kind of an older guy, he is kind of a, I don't want to say exciting fighter, but he still has a lot of fairly good reflexes. And it's unfortunate that that's really all that U.S. fans got to see of him, because he's actually a pretty good fighter.
Agree. And I mean, and as I said, I think he took a lot of heat for that fight, and I don't think it was entirely fair, because I mean, we see, you know, fights where you've got a competitive matchup where fighters just don't take chances because they respect the other guy's ability to counter. And in this situation, it was never competitive. And I thought, you know, I mean, I don't want to now suddenly start criticizing Nonito for the way he fought, but he showed Narvaez, I thought, plenty of respect in that fight by not actually making a concerted effort to go for the knockout. I mean, you know, he was getting countered a bit, and I thought he was almost as responsible for the lack of action. And again, it's not really fair to be critical of a guy that wins a fight 11-1 or 12-0. Yeah, anyway, I don't know what more we can say about that.
Well, we talked about that exact point last week, James, David, and I, just basically that, you know, I'm of the opinion that I thought that Nonito could have stepped up a little bit more, just because there wasn't really anything to lose in going after Narvaez. But, yeah, at the same time, you know, he dominated, and I don't know, it is what it is. You can't really say much more for it in terms of, you know, he should have done this or that, because, you know, now Nonito finds himself where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
But before you go, I actually wanted to touch on one more thing, and this is something that I know James will also have an opinion on or be able to talk about, is basically Andre Ward. You know, he wound up calling the Frotch-Kessler 2 fight alongside the commentators on HBO. And so after the fight, it seemed like there was almost a little bit of, I don't know, it was almost like a little spat between them, and not face-to-face, but basically Carl Frotch was asked, you know, would you like to rematch Andre Ward? And he actually gave two slightly different answers, one on HBO, one in Sky Sports. But in any event, the overall answer was, yeah, if he'll come to the UK. That's basically what I got from it. And so then Andre Ward kind of sounded like he was like, eh, I don't like his answer. And so now I'm going to say, well, he could never beat me, so he's just bitter about it, which may be true. Maybe it is true. But so I guess the question is, do we want that fight? You know, does Andre Ward want that fight? And does he want it in the UK? So, I mean, where do you think the possible negotiations go with this one? James?
Brock is more of a draw. The fight is obviously going to do much better business in the UK. And, I mean, the first fight was in the United States. And so Ward, even though I believe he said he didn't really have hometown advantage because it wasn't in Oakland, but, I mean, it was in America. So, I mean, I kind of think, and it's only fair that if they have a rematch, it's in the UK. But, I mean, you know, boxing's not fair. And, you know, it takes two guys to come to a deal. And, you know, we've seen so many times a fight that should happen that just doesn't happen. I don't know. I think if Ward plays hardball, I mean, he might get Frock to come to the United States again, because I think Frock really, you know, he's a fighter at heart, and I just can't imagine him wanting to let the first result stand. I don't really think he has much chance of beating Ward. But, I mean, I just can't imagine that he, if he has a chance for the rematch and he can't get things his own way, will turn it down.
Yeah, you know, I admire that a lot in Frock.
Really quick, I just wanted to give a quick shout-out to Mr. Pinklin Thomas, former WBC heavyweight belt holder, who's listening to the show. But, James, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and I think that's one of the reasons we all admire Frock so much, because he does seem like he wants to go back and, you know, fight the best Andre Ward again and change that result. But, Andy, I wanted to ask you, because this was kind of another interesting phenomenon on Saturday night. The love fest for Andre Ward as a commentator seemed to subside a little bit. And I was reading a lot of people criticizing him for not giving Kessler and Frock enough credit. And I see, I like Roy Jones a lot in the commentator role, even though maybe I'm kind of in the minority on that one. And my problem with Ward has always been that I feel like he kind of is too diplomatic in a lot of his answers. Mm-hmm. And so he's always kind of, you know, what do you think is going to happen? Well, it could go this way or it could go this way, you know. And here I don't think that was the problem, but I read a lot of people criticizing him for being overly critical of the two fighters on Saturday and feeling like the whole HBO production was just kind of an Andre Ward love fest and like, oh, here's these two, you know, second-tier guys fighting who clearly aren't in the same league as our guy. What did you think about all that?
You know, I wasn't really a fan of Ward's commentary. I felt that you could sense that he was rooting for Kessler to win. You could sense that he just didn't like Frock, and he seemed frustrated by Kessler's performance, and he sounded frustrated in the way of someone, you know, who's rooting for a guy to win and the fight is just not doing the things he wants to see. And I mean we all kind of want a level of detachment from the commentators. I mean, it doesn't exist. I mean, how many times have we complained about the HBO crew favoring one guy or another? So you know, that level of detachment doesn't really exist, but I think we still kind of want to see it. So when we're listening to one of the commentators who sounds like he's, you know, wants the fight to go a certain way, it can get frustrating. And I think, you know, Ward seemed to be rooting for Kessler. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe everyone's wrong. Maybe just as a fighter himself, Ward was seeing things that Kessler should do that he wanted him to do, but I don't know. It just came across to me like Ward was Ward wanted Frock to lose.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting like psychological analysis of Ward.
Why? Well, I mean, I guess I'll throw in my own psycho babble on this, but to me it almost seems like Andre Ward is like bitter about something, like all the time. And I don't get me wrong, I don't mean any disrespect to the guy, and I personally haven't had a whole lot of interactions with him. But for some reason, just, he comes off like he's trying really hard to be a nice guy, and that for some reason, like, there's a part of him that doesn't want to be, you know, that just kind of wants to say, you know, fuck Frotch. I don't want to watch this shit, or something like that, but it's just, I don't know. That's just the feeling that I get.
You know, Ward does come across as I don't know, I think he does come across generally as a nice guy, which is kind of, but between the ropes, you know, he comes across as anything but a nice guy. I mean, he's one of those fighters who's kind of willing to do whatever works. You know, I think some of his recent fights, he's hasn't bent the rules nearly as much, but, I mean, a couple years ago, he had a stretch of fights where, I mean, especially I thought the Kessler fight.
I thought that was pretty bad.
That was pretty bad, and, you know, he just seemed to be willing to do whatever he could to make Kessler uncomfortable, regardless of the rules. But then when he's out of the ring, you know, he seems very polite, seems like a nice guy. So when you're saying that maybe Ward's trying to be a nice guy but isn't, you know, maybe he's real... His real personality is what we see between the ropes. I mean, I don't know. And honestly, never having spoken to him, not knowing him, I think, you know, none of us really can say one way or the other. I don't know. I mean, I've come to really like Ward as a fighter. You know, a few years ago, I wasn't much of a fan. But he's just so clever between the ropes, and he has a bit of a mean streak, and I think it's just, it's not really his fault that he's so much better than everyone else. After the fight, there was a lot of talk about how Frock is entertaining and Ward isn't entertaining, but I think part of the reason why Frock is entertaining is his limitations as a fighter. He can't help but be entertaining if he wants to win. Ward can win without taking damage because he's that good. You know, so I don't know. I've become a bit of an Andre Ward fan, but as a commentator, on Saturday, I didn't really think he did a very good job.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of somewhat indifferent to him because he's had performances where I'm kind of in awe and very impressed and very happy to have seen it. And he's also had performances where it's just a little too rough for me. And I don't mind like some kind of like, you know, trench warfare and stuff like that, especially when it's like mutual. Mm-hmm. But when one guy is kind of trying to do a certain thing and the other guy is, you know, somewhat within the rules, just getting too dirty or getting too rough, I don't know. I'm just not usually a fan of it.
I agree. And I think that was the situation when he fought Kessler, when he fought Green, when he fought Beaker. I thought in all three fights, you know, I thought he was pretty dirty. But I thought against Abraham, Brock, and Dawson, these last three outings, you know, I didn't really have much to complain about as far as his tactics. And I thought, you know, I mean, the fights were all one-sided, but I thought they were relatively entertaining. I didn't, you know, I mean, relatively entertaining is, I mean, they weren't exciting, but I kind of enjoyed watching what Ward was doing. And I mean, in the same way you might enjoy a pitcher, a good pitcher who's, you know, not getting hit. I mean, it's not thrilling, but it can be kind of interesting to watch.
For sure. James, you were about to say something?
Oh, Andy, could I ask you just one question? Kind of
sure.
Historical based for the road here, if you
sure.
got to get going. Just what do you think Sergio Martinez, Hall of Fame?
No, I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but there are quite a few, you know, Hall of Famers in recent times who I didn't think were Hall of Famers either, that, you know, probably will get in. You know, I don't really think, I mean, this has obviously been talked about a lot, that Arturo Gatti is a Hall of Fame resume. You know, Costa Su, I think, was a great fighter. I was a big fan. But, I mean, he doesn't really have, you know, that many outstanding names on his ledger. I think, you know, a guy like Miguel Cotto, everyone thinks is a surefire Hall of Famer. I think when you compare him to some fighters from 30, 40, 50 years ago that are not in the Hall of Fame, I'm not sure he really is better than those guys. So I think the standards have come down in recent times. And because of that, you know, I think Martinez, you know, maybe if he can fight another year or two, has a chance to get in. But, like, right now, I would say no, he's not quite in. But, as I said, there are other guys I would say no, they're not quite in, and they're going to make it.
Well, how do you think, just speaking of Cotto, who a lot of people have said, you know, oh, he's a, you know, first ballot lock, how do you think Martinez rates against Cotto? And do you think that, you know, holding the lineal middleweight championship carries any extra weight there?
Yeah, I think at his best, Martinez is a better fighter than Cotto. I think, you know, he's – so if you're talking – I mean, there's, you know, it's not like other sports, for example, baseball, where, you know, you've got accumulative numbers that carry so much weight and, you know, a player has to be outstanding for, you know, 13, 14, 15 years to make it. Boxing, there are fighters in the Hall of Fame that were, you know, had a peak of two or three years, and many that were only top fighters for, say, 4 or 5 years. So Martinez has been a top fighter for 4 or 5 years, and I think during that period, he's better than Cotto ever was. So, yeah, I think Martinez is better than Cotto. I think I probably... you know, I think most people might disagree with that, but, you know, I mean, we could start to analyze Cotto here, and I don't quite have time, but, you know, Hall of Fame it's, you know, so much of boxing is subjective. I mean, we were discussing earlier with, you know, just scoring fights, and then a career, the career credentials of many fighters comes down to like 3 or 4 fights, and, I mean, that's not much to go on. You know, so right now, Martinez, I mean, because he started late and he only arrived as a championship level fighter when he was ready, I guess maybe 34, 35. He doesn't have that much to go on. Man, it's just so subjective.
Just let us know whenever you got to go. It's not a problem.
Yeah, you know, I probably should have gone 5 minutes ago, but, you know, once we start getting into discussions of, you know, historical nature and, you know, talking about Martinez and Cotto, I can, you know, I can ramble on. So, you know.
Well, we'd love you to, but
show
whenever you got to go.
I can talk for like 5 more minutes. You know, I got to say this before I go, and I've mentioned this to Patrick before, is that when I listen to your show, you know, I listen on my phone, and I set the speed at 1.5. So when I listen, you guys are speaking really quickly, and it's now when I'm listening to you guys talk here, I'm like, man, this feels so slow. This
feels like ice ages.
It's like we're in slow motion. And I mentioned this to Patrick, like I like podcasts that fit into an hour. So, you know, that's why when you guys are 90 minutes, you know, I could listen on 1.5 times speed and fit into an hour perfectly. But now you guys are 2 hours. And I can't listen on 2 times speed because it just, you know, then you just get lost.
Huh, I gotta try that.
It's like I bet you would totally remind me of like people who train themselves to read like one page of the book with one eye and then like the other page with their other eye, so they could read at double speed.
Yeah, but those people are trying to be more productive. I think that's an issue where these are really busy people who are trying to get stuff done. You know, for me, it's more a case of, you know, if I listen to a podcast when I go to the gym for an hour, I'm not likely to go back to that same podcast and listen to the last 20 minutes when I go to the gym the second day. So for me, it's more a matter of convenience. It's like I want to hear everything you guys have to say, but I want it to fit nicely into my schedule.
I guess we're going to have to take that into consideration, James, when scheduling these times in the future.
Yeah, 90 minutes. It's perfect. I think
the
90 minutes is perfect.
The marvels of modern technology.
Yeah.
So, Andy, should we open the dreaded hot button? Where does Floyd Mayweather rank historically?
Oh, my God. You know, I'd
give us
say
a number.
Okay, I'm going to throw out a number and say 35.
That's a good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's always going to be arguments where you could...
Within reason,
you could make that he's maybe top 20. I just don't buy it because of the level of competition. I mean, I understand, you know, if you're just looking at a guy of how good is he on his best night, and if, like... how would he do against other guys? Yeah, you could make an argument that Floyd is higher. But, I mean, I always feel that you need to actually prove it. You need to fight the fights. And in some cases, it's not even Floyd's fault because the competition today just isn't as good as it was even, say, 20, 30 years ago. I mean, I just don't think we have as many good fighters. We don't have the depth of talent. And... in order to get the same kind of challenges for Floyd that, you know, fighters of the past had, you know, he'd have to go up and face bigger guys. And, you know, I personally don't really think it's even fair to expect him to give away 15, 20 pounds in order to seek out challenges. So it's just a matter of timing. I mean, if he had come around 20, 30 years ago, I think we might have seen him against, you know, some better fighters, and, you know, who knows how he would have faced. You know, he might have, had he come around in a different era, based on his talent, who knows, he might be top 10, top 20. But given the information we have to work with, I'd say 35. And, man,
I'd say top 30 is
top 30?
Right,
okay.
About
spot on. Yeah.
James,
so,
what do you think?
So yeah, 30-35.
I'm in the same ballpark, but I haven't seriously looked at it enough to do that. I mean, I kind of just say conservatively top 50. Because it's also, how do you look at Floyd? Do you look at him as a welterweight? I mean, do you look at him at what he did at 130 and 135, where he arguably probably, faced his best competition and won his biggest fights?
I think the welterweight division in recent times has been very thin on talent. And, I mean, when I think of Floyd in all-time sense, I think of a 130, 135-pound guy and how he would have done relative to those guys. Like, I mean, if you were to take Floyd and throw him into against a guy like Basilio or Gavilan, a really big, busy, physical fighters, I don't think he'd have a chance. I mean, I know there's some people who think he'd beat those guys. I don't think he'd have a chance just because he's not naturally big enough to deal with what those guys bring. So in terms of, like, his status as a welterweight all-time, I'm not even sure if he cracks the top 20. But in terms of a fighter, as a guy at 130, 135 pounds, he's definitely one of the greats.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it would have been better for his legacy if he had gone into those divisions maybe like a couple years later and caught those guys like Morales and Barrera and maybe Pacquiao back then?
Yeah, I mean, he would have beat them. It probably would be a little bit better for his legacy. Personally, I think Pacquiao's also, I think in terms of an all-time sense, similar to Floyd. I don't know where you guys have him, but I also don't think he's top 20. And I think a lot of the wins he's had at higher weights, as impressive as they are and as dominant as they are, the competition
they come with asterisks.
Has been there. Yeah, they do.
And some of them come with asterisks.
Yes, they do. And, I mean, there just isn't the competition there is now. We see guys winning 5-6 titles, whatever that even means these days. If Sugar Ray Robinson was around today, he would have won titles, I think, from lightweight to light heavyweight. It's not just Robinson. I think there are a lot of fighters from the past who, against today's competition, would have done some things that are similar to what Manny and Floyd have done in terms of jumping weight.
I just think we need to disregard all the paper titles and just kind of focus on where they've actually been the legitimate champ. And that comes with, of course, like what era you're talking about and who they fought to get there and that kind of thing. But I think Mayweather has a couple there, maybe three lineal titles, and Pacquiao has three or four.
Go ahead. For me, it's not so much titles; it's just who you faced and how you did against them. I mean, there are fighters from the past who never won a title that have amazing resumes. It's just because of the kind of fighters they took on. I mean, a guy like Lloyd Marshall never won a title, but I mean, he had some fantastic wins. I mean, Charlie Burley never won a title, but he had some fantastic wins. Going back further, I mean, Sam Langford, I think, is one of the top five fighters of all time. He never won a title.
Exactly.
And so today, when we start judging fighters by, whether they've won three or four titles and then comparing them to guys in the past, it's just not a good way to do it. Anyway,
I agree.
I think I have to go. But
yeah,
I mean,
you gotta go.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks so much
fun.
For coming on, man. And well, thanks for spending a little extra time with us.
Yeah, no problem. I'm gonna listen to the show. I'm gonna listen on super speed. I'm gonna see how I sound relative to you guys when we're all talking very quickly.
And you're gonna regret telling some of your sordid tales from Atlantic City.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Foley.
I heard nothing.
You know what's funny? It's like we every time we'd come home, it would be light outside, and then
that was the first clue that some stuff went down.
I think it's kind of a good rule here. Up here, the bars close at 2 o'clock, and you can't drink after that time. And then, I mean, it's frustrating. You're like, what do you mean it's 2 o'clock? We But, you know, that's, I think it's kind of a good thing because, you know, when you can stay out to like 4 or 5 and, you know, it's I don't know how people function.
Well,
well, I'm here.
I would defer to you on that topic.
Well, anyway. We'll have you back on to make up for the last hour or something.
Yeah, no, anytime you guys want to have me on, I'd love to be on.
Great.
And thanks for having me this time.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, thanks
again,
man.
You guys. See you. Bye.
Later. So basically I wanted to kind of recap and go back to the Frotch Kessler thing just because I have some questions for you, James.
Oh, yeah.
About the potential, well, I mean, I guess there's been kind of a fairly wide array of discussion, and most of it is involving Andre Ward because, number one, he's been inactive because of injury, well, a handful of injuries, as I understand it, and so I think that people are eager to see him back in the ring and see what happens when he comes back and also who it's going to be against. So I've seen a number of discussions that are involving a potential, even a Kessler rematch and stuff
with
like that. I don't know how realistic, with Ward. And like to say, I don't know how realistic that is. I don't really think that's very realistic at all. But, you know, in any event, I think the bulk of the discussion has been, where does Frotch go? Is there going to be a Ward rematch or a Kessler rubber match? And which one, you know, which one makes more sense from all angles?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that the Kessler rubber match probably makes the most sense in terms of financially, and people have good feelings. Both the fights were good. Ward beat Frock pretty definitively when they did fight. And, you know, if he's not willing to travel to the UK, you could assume that's probably less money on Frock's end if he has to come here. And you know, it may not be as desirable for him to do that. But that said, I mean, I think Frock clearly established himself again. You know, he is the number one guy behind Andre Ward at super middleweight. So, you know, again, he remains Ward's biggest challenger at the moment. And... you know, I don't have any objections either way, but whatever we see next. You know, I like watching Carl Frock fight. I like watching Andre Ward, too. And I think Frock's proven that he's a really good fighter, and he's coming off 2 big wins now. So, you know, I'm cool either way. I think the other thing for Frock is, you know, he's also a desirable opponent for guys kind of trying to come up. And you know, let's say he rematches Ward and he loses that fight. I mean, he's still got the Kessler rematch, but he's also a desirable opponent for guys who maybe want to come up and try to challenge Ward. Fighters who don't have as big of a following, like Gennady Golovkin, would probably love to take on Carl Frock and kind of show that he's a viable guy at 168. You know, a lot of people were talking about just stylistically how great a Chavez Jr. Carl Frock fight would be, because both those guys just have granite chins, and Jr. is going to come forward, and you know, you'd expect that would be a really good fight too. So he's got a lot of options. I think the Kessler, the third fight with Kessler, would probably be the best move economically. And you know, a lot of this kind of depends on how long Ward's going to be out, and does he want to take a fight with Frotch right after all this time out of the ring?
Well, and I think that something that was kind of interesting, especially in the Sky Sports post-fight interview between Frotch and Kessler, was there was kind of just a really short little exchange where they were asking Frotch, you know, what are you going to do now? What about, you know, what do you think about fighting Kessler again, basically? And Frotch turned to Kessler because they were sitting like shoulder to shoulder on the ring apron. And that's how they conduct a lot of post-fight interviews on Sky, actually. Just kind of like the opponents kind of buddying up, you know, I guess if they'll do that. But anyway, Frotch turned to Kessler and he said, what do you think? You know, do you want to do a rubber match? And the first thing Kessler said was, well, where is it going to be? And so I think that maybe opens up a little bit of conversation as far as, well, you know, maybe Frotch, you know, demands that a third fight would have to be like in Nottingham or something like that. And then from there, what if Kessler is like, nah, I was already talking about retirement before the fight, so I think I'm just going to go ahead and retire. And if that were to happen, I'm not going to say that Frotch doesn't have any options or anything, because he does seem to have quite a few, but at the same time, that would seem to be a fairly big option that just fell off the table.
Yeah, it would take away some of his leverage for the ward fight.
Exactly.
Negotiating the ward
fight.
But,
and, you know...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it depends on if, you know, whether... I mean, there's obviously other opponents he can face where Frock would be a pretty significant favorite and, you know, could draw a good crowd in the UK. And also, you know, is Frock a tempting matchup for a guy like Chavez Jr., you know, or Golovkin? I mean, would they see him as, you know, not that big of a risk that they could go up? Are those, you know, is that a winnable fight for those guys? But, you know, the interesting thing was a big part of the debate was kind of, you know, does Andre Ward, you know, should he have to go to the UK? I mean, isn't that what a world champion, you know, you're supposed to go to all over the world and all that stuff. But, you know, when you are the world champion, typically, you've gone somewhere to get that title and then you defend it in your hometown. And I think the fact that, you know, Ward's already beaten Frock, I don't see the real mandate that, you know, he's somehow ducking that fight if he won't go to the UK to do it.
Well, I mean, I personally don't think that I think it basically goes without saying that no, Andre Ward does not have to be, you know, he doesn't have to go to the UK to take that fight.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to take the fight, period. You
We'd
know,
like
I
him
felt
to go
that,
to the UK, but
sure,
I'd love
it if that happened. No, I'd love it if that happened, but at the same time, it just kind of like, well, no, he doesn't have to do anything. He basically holds the cards because he has the title, and not so much that he has the title, but he's just the best fighter in the division. He's proven it. He's undefeated, and it's not one of those, like, you know, whatever, you're touting undefeated because it's just undefeated. He's a good fighter that's defeated everybody he's faced. So in any event, no, he's not obligated, but would I like to see it? Yeah, I'd like to see it for a number of reasons, and because he would get paid more. I don't think that he would take a cut in pay. He would probably just have to take a cut in percentage, which I think that he is in principle against, because I think that he feels, well, I think that we've seen time and again, or at least, you know, through the kind of press negotiations that they do these days, you know, if they're to be believed, it sounds like Andre Ward plays hardball at the negotiating table. And I guess, you know, when you can, you will, but at the same time, it would be nice to see a top fighter, you know, take a big risk in terms of, like, you know, fighting outside of a comfortable element.
Sure.
Which I think that Andre Ward has had the benefit of in the past. When I counted it last time, it was like he's fought outside of California something like twice in his last 15 fights. So, I mean, you know, does that necessarily mean he was given gifts or all this type of stuff? No. But it would just be nice to see a guy get out of his comfort zone. So, yeah, I hope that he does, because I think that's probably the best fight around there to make, short of Andre Ward heading up to 175 pounds.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. And as Frock keeps racking up these wins, I mean, he's, you know, he's just the next best guy. And, you know, you'd like to say, well, see Ward fight other people, but who's there for him right now? You know, so it makes sense that Frock wants to erase that loss. You know, that's probably the best fight in the division.
Well, funnily enough, I know that was basically a rhetorical question from you, but I think it was yesterday that, who was it? I want to say it was, I can't remember what specific person it was, on Team Ward. It might have been like James Prince, or it might have been his trainer. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank right
Virgil
now.
Virgil Hunter.
But yes, Virgil Hunter. I can't remember exactly who it was, but yesterday they said, you know, basically screw a Frotch rematch. We want Calzaghe. And I mean,
oh, yeah, I read about that.
I kind of thought that at first it was like tongue in cheek, but I think that I think it was James Prince, and I think he was being serious.
Well, just like Calzaghe's wins over, you know, Bernard Hopkins and Roy Jones, that really wouldn't do a whole lot for Ward's legacy either. I guess you give Calzaghe some credit for the Hopkins win, but, you know, beating a 41-year-old or whatever he is now, Calzaghe, that's been out for 4 years, that's not going to do a whole lot for Ward's legacy.
Yeah,
but, you know, he's
been out.
Yeah, I mean, but he finds himself in that predicament where he's already beaten the best guy at 175. He's beaten the best guy at 168. You know, I think he's got to just bide his time and hope that some of the best middleweights move up eventually.
Yeah, and I think that a fight that you brought up earlier, that, I mean, I'm not 100% sure that you could make a Andre Ward, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. fight, like, viable right now. Like, if they were to make it next, I'm not 100% sure that I would be up on it.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think that if you, like, for example, let's just kind of throw out a fantasy scenario. Let's say that Sergio Martinez and Chavez Jr. rematched, which it kind of sounds like they might sometime soon. And let's say Chavez Jr. kind of picked up where he left off and wound up winning a rematch. If he were to win a rematch and then maybe move up and get, you know, a decent win or two at 168 over the next year, I think that that's a fight that could be fairly large.
Yeah, I think that's
a little
exactly.
Bit more,
yeah, that's like exactly
a little bit
how
more defining
play out.
For Ward.
Oh, yeah, sure. And, you know, with Chavez, he's in a great position. It's like his skills need to match up to his fame, but he's got a great position to negotiate because he brings a ton of fans and he can draw money. And he's already headlined, you know, a pretty successful pay-per-view in the U.S. and sold out arena. So, you know, he's the type of guy who he could lure Carl Froch into a fight with. You know, and if he beats somebody like that, then that gives him enough credibility to be, you know, a challenger for Andre Ward. I mean, right now Ward's at that, you know, it's like the salad days. He's just he's presumed to be invincible against, you know, every potential challenger. But, you know, as we've seen before, I mean, really Ward's career wins are Froch and Kessler, who are like two really good fighters and the best two fighters in the division. But, you know, there's other guys who can come up and challenge him, and that's how it's going to have to play out. I mean, for money's sake, yeah, I think he wants that Chavez Jr. fight down the road because that's the biggest money guy in his vicinity. But, yeah, Chavez Jr. just needs to get the credibility as a fighter that it's not a totally laughable matchup, which, you know, most people would find that right now. But, you know, Chavez Jr., because of his money, because of the draw, he can get good fighters to fight him, and he can, if he wins those fights, he can increase, you know, his own credibility and his own pedigree.
Well, and you also kind of have to consider that a couple years ago, and by a couple years ago, I mean like maybe three or four, Chavez Jr. was still kind of thought of as a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he first started showing up on Top Rank, you know, pay-per-view undercards and stuff like that, there was just a whole lot of disdain and just kind of disbelief as far as wanting to buy that he is, you know, a legitimate fighter.
Well,
or
a gimmick.
Just kind of a,
yeah,
it was a gimmick. It was an attraction because of his name. But, you know, I said that, you know, slowly but steadily, he was improving as a fighter and actually becoming a pretty decent fighter. And yes, he has had a handful of controversies with, you know, testing positive for diuretics, I think twice, and then, you know, testing positive for marijuana. I mean, whatever. You can't see me right now, but I'm making that like air jerk off motion because I don't really give a shit that he was testing positive for marijuana.
Or the air smoking a doobie motion.
Yeah, exactly. Or the air, you know, pull up in Mike Barolla,
literally
make a drug deal at 7-Eleven motion.
Okay.
I've done that many times, but I don't care anyway, but it was against the rules. So there have been a handful of controversies, and I don't mean to downplay those because I think they are significant. And I think that in order to be taken seriously, he does need to kind of proceed with caution in terms of his, you know, testing and shit like that with his career.
It was a little troubling that during the whole lead up to the Martinez fight, it seemed like Chavez Sr. was the one who was really, you know, drawn out a game plan and really fired up to get in there. Like, he was taking it a lot more seriously than his son was. But, you know, I think the thing, oh, I'm just going to say that I think the thing about that win over, or not win, of course, but, you know, that he came back and was able to knock down Sergio in the 12th round, the reason why that was impressive is because Sergio looked so good in the first 11 rounds of that fight. You know, he still looked like the prime Sergio Martinez. He was so quick and just picked him apart. You know, if Chavez Jr. had had the same kind of fight that, like, Martin Murray had with Sergio, where he looked clearly slower and like, his reflexes were starting to wane, it wouldn't have been as good. But it was the fact that, you know, Sergio looked awesome in the first 11 rounds of that fight, or 10 and a half rounds, and then Chavez kind of started to come on. But it showed something, you know, that he was able to take such a horrible beating and then come back and give himself a chance to win at the end, you know, it just showed something inside of him that, that can make you, I think, a little bit more optimistic about the future.
I think so, yeah. And, I mean, even though the kind of positive testing type of show is distressing, at the same time, you know, he has come a long way from where he was. You know, how he got there, it's kind of tough to say at this point. I don't really want to get into the performance-enhancing drug debate too much, but regardless, I think that in about a year's time, you could potentially see Chavez Jr. in there as, you know, a solid and fairly worthy contender to Andre Ward if he can get there. Whether or not he can, I'm not sure, but I guess that's what we're going to have to see.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to control his own destiny there. But, you know, if he certainly has a path laid out for him to fight some really good fighters and, you know, try to make a name for himself beyond just the son of Julio Cesar Chavez.
Yeah, and, well, you know, he's at this point, you know, we've seen in the last 10 years or so, let's see, we've seen Jorge Paez Jr. We've seen Sal Sanchez, I think the third. I think he is.
Is it Sal Sanchez the second? And he's like his nephew?
I can't remember exactly. I know he's his nephew or his great nephew or something like that, but whatever his name is. And, you know, we've seen Aaron Pryor Jr. We've seen the sons of a whole bunch of different, you know, legends or good fighters of yesteryear, Pepino Cuevas Jr., et cetera. And for the most part,
Floyd Mayweather Jr.
Whoa. Hey there, buddy. Don't try to sully the good Mayweather name here.
Yeah.
Come on. Well, you know what Floyd always says. He's not a junior. He's just
right.
Floyd Mayweather.
Well,
but,
no,
I mean,
Chavez Jr., of the guys whose fathers were really great fighters, he may be the best, I just thinking off the top of my head.
Yeah. And
of this generation.
I'd have to really look into it as far as, like, you know, trying to decide that in terms of history. But right now, I don't think there's any question that he's been really the only junior that's made something of himself on a world-class level and been able to compete there. So, I don't know. I think that's kind of interesting anyway. But before we go, and unless you have, you know, some other stuff to talk about or whatever, like before we head out, I wanted to bring up really quick the Roman Gonzalez fight, just because it's Roman Gonzalez and I like Chocolatito because he's fun to watch and he gets knockouts and he hits hard and he's a good fighter. And on top of that, there's the potential for a showdown with Ioka, I guess later this year. So I don't know. I wanted to bring that up and just kind of talk about it briefly because he's fun to watch and I hope we get to see him on like something like Well TV again.
Yeah, he's a beast. I mean, I would love to see it. And maybe, you know, a lot of these smaller guys aren't with the two major promotional outfits. So maybe, you know, the good thing is a lot of these fights can happen. And with HBO now invested in that Macau market and showing Zhu Shiming, and they've got Estrada on a couple of those cards. You know, the thing about Ioka and Gonzalez, they've both beaten, you know, the probably the best fighter in the division above them in Estrada. And then Gonzalez beat Estrada and Ioka beat Yagashi, who's now the lineal champion of flyweight. So, I mean, these two guys probably are the two best fighters below 115 or 118. And that would be a great matchup. I mean, Gonzalez still hasn't really, you know, the Estrada win has gotten better because Estrada beat Brian Valoria. But
exactly.
This is the problem with those really small weight classes. There's not, beyond the top couple guys in each division, there's not the same depth of, like, really talented fighters. And Gonzalez still hasn't really, you know, I mean, beaten a guy on his own level. So, yeah, he's definitely really fun to watch, and he's, you know, got a ton of power for that weight class. So I certainly look forward to watching his career. I think he's pretty young, too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, I want to say, like 25. I had to look it up here, but he's 25. And Kazuto Ioka, he's 24.
Yeah, he's young, too, and Estrada's really young.
When
these guys can be making
Yagashi,
some great fights in that division.
Yeah, the win over Yagashi was in Yoka's 10th fight. So, I mean, like, you know,
he's been compared to Rigondo in some ways as being one of the most accomplished pros with that few amount of fights.
For sure, and, like, that's deserved. But I also, I want to just say that that's fairly typical of guys who are in small weight classes, just because I think that there's less of a, like, kind of a courting period or, you know, a grooming period when there are prospects and stuff like that, because there's not much TV involved or TV money. So there's not as much pressure, you know, to keep an undefeated record and stuff like that. You know, it's unfortunate that more networks and stuff don't pick up the little guys, because, you know, the fights for the most part, well, I don't want to overgeneralize, but they tend to be pretty fun. They throw a lot of punches, you know, and it's not often that you see a guy, like you said, that small in Roman Gonzalez who can really punch. You know, most of them, I feel like most fights at that level, at those weights, tend to, you know, either go the distance or, you know, end on like a kind of like a headbutt or a cut or something like that, rather than flat out, you know, stopping guys like he does.
Well, that's why a lot of those fights turn into just like wild brawls, because they don't have the same kind of power as some of the bigger weights do.
It's great. I mean, I wish that American audiences got to see more of it, really. And I mean,
I'm just thinking maybe with HBO2 showcasing some of those smaller fighters, you know, down the road, these guys will get an opportunity.
I hope so, because Roman Gonzalez, you know, the only American TV that, you know, he's gotten on in the last little while was that Wealth TV card with Estrada, which was, you know, that was an outstanding fight. And of course, like you said, in retrospect, the win seems to get better. So that's great, but that's still fairly small time, you know.
And he's one of the most exciting. Yeah, he's one of the most exciting fighters in the sport now. And
yeah,
I mean, he's gotten a lot of word of mouth. I mean, I think there's an audience to see him on one of these bigger cards. But I don't know, like, how much money these guys make, and, like, could they fit, you know, could they do, like, a Showtime undercard or something like that? I'm not sure, like, what Gonzalez used to making, in it, you know.
Well, I mean, he's
fought from Nicaragua or something like that.
Yeah, he's fought in Nicaragua a handful of times, and so I can't say what he makes there or how popular he is there, really. I honestly have no clue at all. But
yeah,
he's also fought
like
in
crowds there, but
yeah, but he's fought in Mexico a handful of times. He's fought in Southern California. He's fought in Vegas a few times, I think. So I mean, I'm sure that he's made some relatively substantial money, but he's certainly not getting paid, you know, high six figures or, you know, in the seven figure range, or at least I can't imagine he is. So I don't see why he couldn't be in a co-feature, you know, like in a Showtime co-feature or something like that. That would be, I don't know, that would be a
I'd much rather watch like a championship level fight in these weight classes than watch, you know, some prospect coming up fighting against like something like that you usually get on these cards, you know, one of the promoter's prospects just fighting against kind of a journeyman type.
Well, like a Gary Russell Jr., for example, who has been, you know, given how many chances against, you know, pretty much, you know, no offense to his opponents, but nobody's. So, I mean,
that's getting a little
out
of hand, that he's still on getting TV appearances with no opponent.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess I'll just kind of turn the conversation into that. I mean, I've heard a couple of rumors and, you know, read some whatever little gossipy type things saying that there was a potential for Gary Russell Jr. fighting Johnny Gonzalez. So, I mean,
yeah, I saw that.
Do you have any feeling on
it
that?
It said Gonzalez didn't want it. It said Gonzalez wouldn't take that fight.
Doesn't really surprise me. I don't think that, and don't get me wrong, because I'm not trying to just shit all over Gary Russell Jr. here, but I guess that's pretty much what I'm about to do. You know, I have actually written in the past, maybe about 2 years ago, Gary Russell Jr. was actually featured in an 8-rounder on HBO. And the reason for that, or at least the reason that was given, was that he had been having hand issues and didn't want to go full 10 rounds. And so during the broadcast, they'd actually kind of somewhat briefly touched on it. And when they did, they had also mentioned something along the lines of, the last time we had an eight rounder here on HBO was like, you know, X amount of years ago, and it was like 20 years or something. And so, in any event, when I'd written about it, I had just basically written that it sure as hell seems like he's getting special treatment. And it seems that while Golden Boy now seems to be pushing a handful of their other fighters a little more hard, like, for example, look at guys like Keith Thurman, who has, I mean, I'm not saying that Keith Thurman's at the top or anything, but he certainly seems to be coming along at a relatively brisk pace in terms of when we first took notice of him. But now Gary Russell Jr., we've already seen this guy in features or co-features or in any event getting some headline time. And this is going on 3 years now. And
yeah,
I think that it's pretty fair to say he's not a prospect anymore.
Right.
But at the same time,
you know. He looks like a special fighter. He's got really fast hands. He's a really good boxer, and he was on this upward trajectory. But at a certain point, yeah, it was like his level of competition just completely fell off, and it's like they can't line up a good opponent for him. And I think he's been out for a while because of those hand injuries, but every time he's been on the air the last, like, year and a half, it's been against an opponent that they lined up, like, 2 weeks before the fight, when he's clearly seems like he's got the talent to be fighting better guys.
And I'm not going to trash him because of his injuries, because that really sucks. There have been a handful of guys who've had their you know, potentially, you know, lucrative or great careers ruined because of injuries. David Reed is a good example. His eye injury, which came in the, I want to say, the 95 Goodwill games against Daniel Santos. You know, David Reed with that kind of droopy eyelid, he wound up getting a bad eye injury and then kind of got pushed along really hard in his career because of that, and his career ended pretty early. Mm-hmm. But so I don't want to trash Gary Russell Jr. because he's had injuries, because it's unfortunate and that sucks. But at the same time, if that's what it's going to be, if it's going to be like one fight against a nobody and then 9 months off, and then another fight on TV against a dude we don't know and then 9 months off, I mean,
it's just confusing.
It's
more than anything.
Better than that. And it's wasting airtime. It's giving away TV dates to other guys who could take them and would be happy to, and would be happy to fight somebody much better for maybe less money. So, I don't know. It's kind of shitty. I feel bad for him because of the injuries, but at the same time, it's kind of like, well, then his handlers and the promoters need to be a little bit more honest with what they're peddling.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, at one point he was a lot more highly regarded than Adrian Broner, because I remember them, I think they were both on the same card one time a couple years ago. And, you know,
I want to say that was when Broner fought Perez or something like that. But, well, in any event, to kind of answer your question from before about the Johnny Gonzalez thing, you know, I totally admit I'm a Gonzalez fan once again. And not to totally defend that decision too much, but I think that at this point in his career, Johnny Gonzalez is not looking to be the B-side of a guy who has not, as of yet, fought anyone remotely credible. So
yeah,
I don't know how much money he was offered. Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that if they offered him really good money, he would have taken it. But I have really no idea. I wasn't there. But I would imagine they probably didn't offer him a whole lot of money. And so, for not a whole lot of money in a position like that, I'm not really that surprised that he didn't take it. I think that he's probably looking more towards like a Ponce de Leon rematch or something like that that's a little bit more meaningful to him, you know, at this point in his career. Whether or not that pans out, I really don't know.
Let's see. I think that's fair to say.
Did you have anything in particular that you wanted to bring up before we close this out?
Don't think so. I think we covered all the frock bases.
All right.
Are you with me on the Kessler frock 3?
I think that that's if they can get that done. I think that they can actually do that in a semi-neutral site. Where exactly that would be, I don't know. It would have to be somewhere, I guess, kind of split between England and Denmark. Where that would be, like I said, I really have no idea. But if they could do something like that and make it neutral to the point where it was agreeable for Kessler, then I would think that that would probably be the best option, especially in terms of action, too, because we've already had two really good fights. And so, you know, it was kind of like going into Pacquiao Marquez 4. A lot of people were, you know, kind of bitching and moaning about it and, you know, talking about Pacquiao Marquez 17 and shit like that. And, yeah, I got it. I understand. You know, you want to see these guys take on other guys, and I understand that. But at the same time, for me, it's like, well, if they already fought 3 times, the first 3 fights were really good. I can't see any way that the 4th fight isn't really good, too. And in terms of just, you know, explosive action, the 4th fight was the best fight. And so it's not to pat myself on the back, but just to make the point that they've already fought 2 times and it was great. So I can't see it, you know, not being great a 3rd time, too.
Yeah, I like the idea of trilogies, too. I just like that, you know, it's 1-1. And I think Kessler showed enough in that fight that it's not ridiculous. You know, if he had just looked totally washed up and Frock walked right through him, knocked him out or something, then obviously there's no point. But, you know, there was enough back and forth action, and Kessler had enough moments to where I think a third fight's a good play, you know. And you've got to make Frock the favorite because he's a little fresher, just kind of like we had him going into this fight. But, you know, it'd be a good thing for him, I think, to just get the official 2-1 nod there before he moves on to Andre Ward. And who knows when Ward's going to be back or, you know, what the deal is with him with his injuries.
I think that's a pretty good point. I think that, it wasn't so one-sided on my side. You know, even though I did score it kind of in the 9-3 range, I don't think that it was so one-sided that, you know, a rubber match is out of the question. And there were chunks of time where Kessler did seem to kind of be in control, or at least kind of wrest control from the hands of Carl Froch, you know, even if it was somewhat brief. There were kind of, you know, minutes at a time where he was, you know, doing very well. So, yeah, I'm with you that I think that that's probably the best option right now. And that, I would say probably Carl Froch would win a rubber match. But Mikkel Kessler, he's had a long career, and if that's how he's going to go out, it would be a good payday for him to go out on.
Yeah.
Well, I guess before we head out of here, I just want to I want to thank everyone who tuned in to listen live. I want to thank Mr. Fruman, Andy Fruman from The Cruelest Sport. Once again, if you guys get a moment, please do visit that site. It's got some absolutely tremendous writing on it, some really good boxing history stuff. They're all of them, Jason Karp, Michael Nelson, Rixio, I think it's Saldivar. I think he is all of them. They're good writers.
And the obligatory Jimmy Tobin hand job.
Of course. I think every single show we've done, someone has brought him up because he's a great writer and he does deserve some praise.
A supernova.
But also he does. He's good shit. And also really quick before we go, I'd actually been told maybe a little less than a week ago that a writer named John Florio is coming out with a new book called One Punch from the Promised Land about Leon and Michael Spinks. And so the reason why I bring that up is because I like to read. I have, you know, about a shelf and a half on my bookcase, which is a big bookcase dedicated to just boxing books. You know, and if anybody wants to know, one of the other shelves is dedicated to Maya mythology, because that's just how I fucking roll. But anyway, this author, John Florio, is coming out with a new book. Yes, Maya mythology and hieroglyphs and all that type of shit, because that's what I'm interested in. And in history, because I don't really like fiction. I basically just read nonfiction. But anyway, John Florio, he's coming out with this book, and the reason why I bring it up is because he has said that before tonight, if anybody is able to go to his Facebook page, the book is called One Punch from the Promised Land. He said that tonight he'll basically pull names out of a hat so that someone can be sent a free personalized copy of the book that hasn't been released yet. It's not going to be released till like September or something like that. And so it's already gotten some good, like, you know, pre-reviews or whatever. For example, Bob Costas said that it was really good. So awesome. In any event, if you want to find John Florio on Twitter, his handle is Florio Writer, WRITER. And he said he'll also honor the people that follow him on Twitter and pull those names out of the hat as well. So, in any event, it's a good opportunity to snag a free book that might be cool for anybody who's interested. And also, I told him that I would kind of give him a plug. So I was obligated to. Kidding. Wanted to. So anyway, James, send them all.
Just send me half the check.
Well,
thank you, Patrick.
You know, I don't know how much royalties I'm getting, but we'll see. Well, send us off, dude.
Well, I just want to say thanks to Andy Fruman again from The Coolest Sport. That's at Grumpy Old Sport on Twitter. Pretty entertaining guy, although he does seems like he watches Big Brother Canada just a little bit too much. But
that's a warning to anybody going to follow him.
Yeah, unfollow him, unfollow him during the Big Brother season, and then refollow him for boxing and baseball and all sorts of other good stuff. Patrick, I got to turn it over to you, man.
All right, no problem. Well, anyway, visit queensburyrules.com, the site that I write for, Patrick Connor, and James Foley writes for badlefthook.com. So check those places out. We'll be here next week to talk about some more boxing because there's definitely a lot more stuff going on the following weekend. This weekend, sorry we didn't preview much, but it's basically Matthew Hatton fighting. And no offense, Hatton family, but we're good. So everybody else, thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Take it easy, everybody.